This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Imagine this. You just get off a plane after a long flight. In fact, after a long journey far from your home country, and you don't know where you are.
There was no welcoming party, so the group wandered some 3.5 miles to Martha's Vineyard Community Services in Edgartown.
Immigrants who were told that they would be greeted here with a place to stay and with jobs.
Sound there from WSAZ-TV, and it includes State Representative Dylan Fernandez, who represents Cape Cod and the Islands. And he's talking about the roughly 50 South American migrants who landed on Martha's Vineyard yesterday afternoon after being falsely lured onto a flight in Texas with promises of work papers, jobs, shelter. This is an unfolding story, but it is life right now for those migrants who have endured so much already. Gladys Vega is executive director of La Colaborativa, formerly known as the Chelsea Collaborative, and they have worked with migrants from the southern border on resettlement. She joins us now. Gladys, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me over.
So Gladys, I'm going to set this up a little bit more. About 50 people, Venezuela and Colombia, where they're coming from, they cross the southern border, where according to the Department of Homeland Security, a record number of people have died in the attempt to cross the border over the last year. Someone makes false promises to get them on a plane, which then lands in Florida and South Carolina before landing without warning on Martha's Vineyard. They walk 3.5 miles to find help because no one's even there when they disembark. There's a lot of conversation about this right now, Gladys, but I wonder, as much as anything, is this a story of strength and resilience, actually?
For me, it's the story of lots of immigrants that have come to United States. For me, it's the story of many of the people I serve in my community. We have also been getting those people from Venezuela, Peru, and Colombia recently. We did this with unaccompanied minors in 2014. We opened the doors. We are a sanctuary city. We do what it takes. And if they were to come here, we'll welcome them with open arms, and we'll figure out as a community together. La Colaborativa has been doing this for approximately 30 years. And most recently, we've been sort of like dealing with so many other problems, such as providing families with food, utilities, rental assistance, mental health, looking for housing. We're doing whatever it takes. Our brothers and sisters coming from here are fleeing because they feel that they were going to get the sanctuary. And they were fleeing because of devastating conditions in their countries, inflicted sometimes by the politics of the government and another human crisis. But we are here to lend a hand and continue to do the work that we need to do in order for us to serve our community and the newcomers. We were not asked to choose the country of origin, right? So as people that have come to the United States, we all have to sort of like figure out ways to help these families, lend a hand and make sure that we serve them and that we serve them well.
So Gladys, let me just pick up there, please. Yes. There's a lot in what you've already said, and I'd like to pick up a couple of those threads.
Sure.
So we know that these men, women, and children came often with no luggage. Many had no idea where they were. Here's State Senator Julian Sear, who represents the Cape and the Islands, speaking with WBUR's Morning Edition this morning.
Island officials moved heaven and earth to essentially set up the equivalent of the shelters that we would put in place for a hurricane or a nor'easter, did that, you know, in a matter of hours.
And Governor Charlie Baker has no public events today, but in a statement to WBUR, his office said that short-term shelter services are being provided to the migrants and, quote, the administration will continue to support those efforts, unquote. I thought about that comment from Julian Sear because you were just talking about the way a whole community has to come together to be welcoming and supportive. What does it take, Gladys? Tell us a little more.
So sincerely, it basically takes an organization or a church that opens the door, and then a whole community of network and supporters and lawyers and neighbors and church-going people. We come together, we text, you know, our network and say, identify, you know, 100 codes. Let's give them rental assistance. Let's send them to Market Basket with gift cards so they can buy food. Let's buy them food while we are doing the interview. Let's feed them. Let's make sure that they feel welcome. Let's also call for mental health. Let's make sure that MGH knows if they're vaccinated or not. I mean, in this coming up Saturday, we have a small clinic just for approximately 40 families. And it's a very private clinic, so we don't want to overwhelm them. But that's exactly what we're doing. They come into my office. We're going to sort of like provide all the wraparound services with some of our nonprofit organizations in MGH. And then we're going to take them to MGH and figure out if they need vaccination, if they need a physical. And that's what we're doing in Chelsea. So, I mean, if we can use models like that, and then also we are working closely with the school department to register in the school system.
So
that is happening.
That is a tremendous amount of work, and the range of that work, right? Everything from legal services to grocery store gift cards and everything in between. So help us understand what it would mean to have roughly 50 people arrive completely unannounced, both in terms of the impact it has. I mean, this is a fundamental affront to human dignity, and we need to say that right up front. And also to scramble to provide that kind of support when you want to do it in a way that respects fundamental human dignity and therefore requires all of those pieces.
Yeah. I think I literally think that it basically takes the willingness of ourselves and our neighbors and people that have come together. I have no, I am not shy for devastation or crises. I have the experience. I have the networks. I have the support. So, I mean, if that was to happen in Chelsea, you have to understand that Chelsea is still suffering from the crises of COVID and how drastically we were impacted. But these are human beings. So we could not shut the doors if something was to happen like that in our city. I mean, I immediately got nervous when I saw it in the news because I said Cape Cod is a central city. Does that mean that Chelsea's next? And we're meeting the group that is meeting on that is doing this thing on Saturday. We're thinking what would happen if that happens to us. And what would happen is that we would face it hands on. We would do whatever it takes. We would call our friends at the police department, tell them any donations of clothing. We would call, you know, our friends from Job Lab. Do you have any codes? Do you have any food in the New England Produce Center? We would sincerely, God bless us, and hopefully this changes. But if it doesn't change it, let it be, and we'll welcome them. We've been here before. We have the experience. We have the networks. We have the resources. And the most important thing, we have worked with people that have that resiliency. We have worked with people that have been broken. We have worked with people that have been raped as they're crossing the border. We have worked with people that have nothing in their backpack, nothing but a phone number in their t-shirt.
Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead and finish that sentence.
If that's what they get, that then they'll have a little bit much more, because we will work very hard to get them to a level of dignity that they're treated with respect, regardless how they enter the country.
So I want to underscore two things there. You talked about, you know, one of the first conversations was, we're also a sanctuary city. There is reporting people were told they were going to Boston, and we are seeing this elsewhere. Chicago, New York, just today, actually in front of Vice President Kamala Harris's house in Washington, D.C. So we know, you know, that it's possible that there will be more of this. The other thing I think I want to underscore from what you just said, Gladys, those horrible experiences of the people that you've supported could be the experiences of the roughly 50 people who landed in Martha's Vineyard and were used as pawns. Yeah. So a couple of other things. Senator Elizabeth Warren tweeted this morning, exploiting vulnerable people for political stunts is repulsive and cruel. Massachusetts is fully capable of handling asylum seekers, and I'll keep working with local, state, and federal partners to ensure we have the necessary resources to care for people with dignity, end quote. Are you, as a person and a provider, Gladys, are you angry today?
Of course I am. Of course I am. I am angry because no one is deserves to be told that they're going to a place that they're going to be offered something. And then when they come, tell me the truth. Tell me, listen, whoever wants to be dropped off at an airport and then you find your housing on your own or whatever, give me the truth and I'll deal with the truth. Don't tell me something different. I say, because it gives a bad taste, but it also gives a bad taste of what city officials are like. My situation in the city of Chelsea is not like that. We have amazing state rep, amazing federal delegation, amazing politicians. So the fact that, you know, from Florida, from New York, or from Texas, they telling them, come and we're going to do this, it's ridiculous. You know, just tell them the truth, and then if you guys want to risk it and come, then let it be. But don't tell people like that. Don't say that. That's inhumane. And Americans are much better people than that.
Do the people who have landed now in Martha's Vineyard, lured again under false pretenses onto a plane in Texas, do they have any control over their lives right now? If they want to leave the vineyard, can they go somewhere else if they want to?
You know what? I have no idea, but the ones that are coming to Chelsea, they said that they dropped them off at the airport a couple of days ago. Some people found them when the first 50 came, and then they learned about Chelsea, and they knew that there were a lot of immigrants like themselves, and they came.
And so when was this?
We've been having groups of people coming probably within the last, I want to say, a month already, a month, 5 weeks. Yes. Yeah, but it hasn't been like a bus full of people. It has been, you know, three families from Peru, two families from Colombia, that they're in the airport, that they drop them in Connecticut somewhere or like that. So, or that they came from New York, and they have the papers of a place where in Texas they were in a refugee center. So we also have to figure out, are these legit people that came in the bus? And yes, they are, because they have some type of documentation that they were in a location of refugee.
And Gladys, how do you find out that there are families standing at airports who've been shipped off?
Sincerely, we have a lot of Chelsea residents. This is incredible. We have a lot of Chelsea residents that work in the airport, and they say, go to La Colaborativa.
Wow.
And that's how it's basically people in they find them in a bed or in a sofa with no place to go, and they bring them to La Colaborativa. And we're like, and immediately I'm like, okay, is this legit? Our staff is told to tell them, do you have any documentation? Welcome and blah, blah, blah. And we immediately feed them because we bet that they must be hungry from being in the airport. So we welcome them, and then we were like, when we incorporated a question, did they give you any notification? Are you aware that you have to follow up in case of you need to change the venue to the if you have a court hearing? Now that court hearing has to be in Massachusetts. And immediately they open up, they pull their little envelope or piece of paper, and they tell us where they came from and who's sending them here. And that's how we find out that they're legit.
So Gladys, you know, yes, that there are those who will say they came here illegally, we owe them nothing. And they'll even argue, as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis did in a statement, yes, to NPR when he was claiming responsibility for this flight, that sanctuary, yes, cities actually encourage illegal behavior. How do you respond to that?
That is not true. That doesn't encourage legal behavior. What that encourages is a relationship with law enforcement. In the city of Chelsea, our undocumented immigrants are not afraid of the police. They know that they're not ICE agents. They built a relationship. When they witness a crime, they call the police. They trust our partners, our nonprofit organizations, and city officials. That is not true. And you know what? The vast majority of Americans would not agree with what is happening, because we can never forget where we came from, and the United States was always built with immigrant blood and sweat. We can never forget that. And we cannot forget that unless we, an indigenous community, we were also immigrant at one point of our life.
So Gladys, what can listeners who want to help do right now to help La Colaborativa in your work, to help folks coming over the southern border?
So I think it's ideally just reach out. And if you are a lawyer and you can donate your pro bono services, if you may want to donate anything in terms of clothing, just reach out and let us know what we need. Like, right, you know, ask La Colaborativa, hey, how can we help if you're helping families? And we will tell you what to do.
Website and phone number, Gladys, just quickly.
Our phone number is 617-889-6080.
889-6080.
Yeah, 6080. 617-889-6080. And I also think it's like, let's help also Cape Cod, let's help the communities that are facing this group of people coming in. I really think that we all have to work together to build a better Massachusetts like we always do. People from Boston are incredible people. I was shown that during the pandemic, and I'm forever grateful.
And we will put your contact information on our website. And thank you for the exhortation to support people in Martha's Vineyard as well. That is Gladys Vega, who's executive director of La Collaborativa, formerly known as the Chelsea Collaborative. Gladys, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
There are about 850,000 Latinos in Massachusetts, according to the Boston Foundation. Migration from places like Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, to the Northeast goes back to the 1940s. And today, Latinos in Boston make up 16% of all Latinos in the state. And while these communities have been in the state for decades, they are often underrepresented in everything from politics to the arts. Well, today marks the official start of Hispanic Heritage Month, and we want to explore the Latino filmmaking community as a new Latinx film festival aspires to bring Latino culture to the masses. We're joined now by Cinefest Latino Boston's founder and executive director, Sabrina Aviles, and Boston-based filmmaker Monica Cohen. Sabrina, welcome.
Hi, welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here in Studio 2. And Monica, great to have you on the line.
Thank you, Tatiana.
So, Sabrina, I want to start with Cinefest Latino Boston. What is it?
Basically, Cinefest Latino Boston was an opportunity for me to start a film festival from the ground up. I had been the director of the Boston Latino International Film Festival for the last 5 years, but I wanted to take it. I wanted something to take it from the ground up and expand upon the contacts and collaborations I've made over the last 5 years. So, and it's my baby right now. So it's another huge production, and I'm ready for the challenge.
So. And so what happens to the Boston Latino International Film Festival?
I don't know what the future of that will be. It's up to the owner. As far as I know that I'm focused more on Cinefest Latino Boston.
And that launches on September 29th.
Exactly. Our big kickoff is officially on the 29th, yes.
So, Monica, what does it mean to have a film festival like Cinefest here in the Boston area?
Well, it means everything. It means that we have representation in the state. It means that we have a place to show our films. It means that the public has a place to see us and recognize our lives beyond maybe some numbers on the news, or they see our lives in depth through film, and that means the world to our communities.
Sabrina, what's missing in the ecosystem that you're hoping the Cinefest Film Festival will help bring forward or draw out?
I mean, I think that I've always used seeing the power of film as a springboard to have larger discussions about what's going on. I mean, even earlier, what's going on in Nantucket is just appalling. But, you know,
sorry, Martha's Vineyard. Just
Martha's Vineyard, sorry. but in... You know, my goal is to show, not only highlight those situations and have deeper conversations beyond what you see in the headline, but also show another side to who we are and what we've contributed to this country as far back as, you know, even before the New England was colonized. You know, the first language outside of the indigenous languages that was spoken here in the United States was Spanish. So we're rich in history. We've contributed a lot to this country, and we have to be acknowledged and respected accordingly. So that's part of what I want to showcase that we're just more than headlines.
So we're speaking with Sabrina Aviles and Monica Cohen about the new Cinefest Boston Latino Film Festival. And Monica, what Sabrina just said makes me think of your 2018 film, Boston's Latin Quarter, which really looks at the history of the Latin Quarter in Jamaica Plain and tracks that history all the way up to its beginning of concern about dismantling because of gentrification. Talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, so the film really happened at the moment where our neighborhood, Jamaica Plain, was being designated, or that part of Jamaica Plain was being designated as a cultural district, as a Latin American cultural district, specifically for the Afro-Latino community. So it's looking back into that history and that specific moment in time where finally the city is looking at this neighborhood and recognizing its history and the population and everything that this community has given to Boston. And so Boston is finally shedding some light into this neighborhood and recognizing the existence of this community, and opening it up for the rest of the city. So yes, my film, it's a short film, and it looks into this moment. We talk to small business owners and longtime residents of Jamaica Plain and community activists that have fought for over 40 years to make this place what it is right now.
So here's actually, Monica, a little bit of sound from Selena Miranda, the executive director of the Hyde Square Task Force, in your film.
There is something so rich about having a city that affirms its diversity, its cultural and ethnic and racial diversity. I think it can move us as a city forward.
So you talk about that 40-year history, Monica. Do you feel like the city is moving forward and things like this new Cinefest Latino Boston helps do that?
Absolutely. I think Cinefest, together with other city initiatives to bring some highlight into our communities like the Latino community in Boston, give us the opportunity to bring into the foreground what we've done and also present ideas to grow the city in a way that is more inclusive. I think Boston have not done that in the past in the most beautiful way for some of our communities, but it's moving forward towards that direction.
We're speaking with, go ahead and finish your thought.
No, what I was going to say is Cinefest and the designation of the Latin Quarter and designation of other cultural districts around us is a way that the city is like moving forward in that sense.
We're speaking with Monica Cohen, who's a Boston-based documentary filmmaker, and Sabrina Aveles, Boston Cinefest Latino Boston's founder and executive director, Boston University graduate. You've been making films in the area for 30 years.
Yes.
Why settle here? What's been that legacy for you as a filmmaker to do it here?
You know, I always had intentions after I graduated from BU to go back to New York, but I was really fortunate in that a few months after I graduated, I landed a job at WGBH. And that sort of dictated the tract that I was going. I thought I had aspirations to go to Hollywood. But at WGBH, I realized that through documentary filmmaking, because I'm mostly a documentary filmmaker, it was a chance for me to, I naturally, because I was a Latina, a lot of the projects that I worked on were about social justice and the Latino community. And so it was a way to sort of find my voice and if my community organizing, if you will, you know, highlighting, the experiences that we had as a community here in the United States. So it was just a natural tract. And then, of course, I got married and had children, so that kept me here. So I've been really fortunate, and I've worked with great people. And I just recently just finished a documentary about the Chelsea Eats program in Chelsea. So I know Gladys Vigo very, very well.
That's great. Yeah, what a small world.
Very small world.
And Monica, does that resonate with you also as a documentary filmmaker, that Boston is a place that you can tell stories that help you find your own voice and the voices of other people you want to bring forward?
Well, similarly to Sabrina, I used to live in New York City and happened to move to Boston because of job opportunities. But I found here a very close niche community of filmmakers. We support each other so much. Sabrina, it's been an incredible ally of us filmmakers in the city, especially Latinos, and others alike, women filmmakers. We've allied to help each other and support each other in our work. So Boston, I have to thank Boston immensely and the community of filmmakers that are here, because even though it's small, we are strong and we support each other in ways that sometimes in New York City is really hard to find.
So that's Monica Cohen, again, Boston-based documentary filmmaker. I'll turn now back to Sabrina Aviles, who's the executive director and founder of Cinefest Latino Boston. Let's talk about the festival for a minute. And so you open with a viewing of the 2021 film Fly So Far. It was made by a Swiss Salvadorian filmmaker, Selena Escher. And it highlights the story of Teodora Vasquez, who was sentenced, this is incredible, sentenced to 30 years in prison for having had a late-term miscarriage in El Salvador. Here's a little bit of the trailer for that film.
Primero dijeron que era aborto. Y después lo cambiaron de aborto a homicidio agravado. Me penaron para 30 años.
Again, that's a clip from the 2021 film Fly So Far, which you'll be showing at the Emerson Paramount Theater on Thursday, September 29th. In the clip, Vasquez says that at first officials charged her with abortion, which is illegal in El Salvador, and then they changed that charge to aggravated homicide before sentencing her to 30 years. You made a choice to open this new festival with that film. What goes into that choice?
I mean, I think, again, as I referenced before, part of what we want to do is use the film as a springboard for larger conversation. And when I saw the film, which, by the way, is being co-presented with a Bright Light Cinema series at Arts Emerson, it just resonated very greatly with me. I literally saw it only a few weeks after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. And so I just thought that there's so many parallels to this. And, you know, and for me, it's a very personal film because, you know, here's a case where women, and of course it's women of color, indigenous women, that are being dictated to as to what to do with their body by clearly patriarchal society. And so I'm really excited about this film. It is not a coincidence, you know. It is just a hot topic in the United States, and one that we really need to continue having discussions about. And we are going to have an amazing panel afterwards with some people in the community that are working around health and health issues and reproductive rights. So again, it serves as a springboard to have these larger communities and the complexity of themes like abortion and women's right to choose.
So let's touch on the other films. There's Utama by Bolivian filmmaker Alejandro Grisi, which is about an elderly couple in Bolivia who really are forced to through changes because of climate change. Mm-hmm. And then you also have 2021's musical El Rey de Todo el Mundo by Spanish filmmaker Carlos Saura. That one explores the connections between Spain and Mexico. Monica, these are great filmmakers. What does it mean to be able to bring new artists, new creative directors to the Boston community to show their work?
Well, it means that the public is exposed to great art and meaningful stories. And as Sabrina was saying, yeah, you're sparking important conversations that hopefully will spark some change and some move, not only on the state, but hopefully, within our communities and farther. Great artists come with great storytelling, and great storytelling is transformative.
Sabrina, what's the long-term dream?
Oh, my goodness. The long-term dream is that I really admire the work that's being done with Black Star Film Festival in Philadelphia. I'd love Cinefest Latino Boston to be something like that, to have, the community, the Latino community in the United States and maybe even internationally to recognize us as one of the top Latino film festivals here.
So tell us, what's in that Black Star Film Festival that you want to see here? What intrigues you about it so much?
I would love more collaborative partnerships with organizations like Sundance, like Firelight Media, all these organizations that I do have contacts with and see them not only support the festival, but maybe in the long term, not only showcase the talent of Latino filmmakers, but maybe mentor or even, mentor them through fellowships and workshops and all that. That's my long-term goal. And also to support, not forgetting the community here in Boston, and to support Latino filmmakers in the community, because there is still, we're still behind the eight ball, you know. There's been this resurgence of people of color, more inclusiveness when it comes to people of color. But we as Latino, I feel we're still a little bit behind the eight ball. And I think part of it is educating young Latinos that filmmaking and the film industry is a viable community. So we try to partner up with organizations like Zoomix to highlight the talent that is here.
All right. Sabrina Aviles is executive director and founder of Cinefest Latino Boston, which launches on September 29th. And Monica Cohen is a Boston-based documentary filmmaker. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tatiana.
It smells so good in Studio 2 right now. I can't even tell you, because there are some special dishes sitting in front of me, and I'm very excited about this segment. So over the years hosting this show, I've been lucky enough to talk with chefs who are doing amazing things across this region, and I've gotten to taste some of their incredible creations. But today, I get to pretend I'm Mary Berry, all right, or one of the other food judges, and I get to judge because two of our chef friends have been kind enough to indulge us. They're here with two unique creations, which I'm going to get to taste without knowing who's who, and I promise I don't. We had two producers bring them in last second and lay them out in front of me, and I've seen no information on this. And then I'm going to decide which dish I think reigns supreme, which, let's be clear, means nothing. Right? Except fun. So joining us here in Studio 2, two incredibly talented chefs. Chef Lambert Givens is the executive chef at Hunter's Kitchen and Bar in South Boston. Chef Lambo, welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
It's great to have you back. And Chef Joe Gatto, who is a private chef, culinary instructor, and host of From Scratch on Pluto TV and has been a frequent flyer here on Radio Boston. Welcome back, Chef Joe.
I love being here. This is going to be a blast. It was like the Oscars out there, so secret.
No. And you two are such good sports to do this, and we're really appreciated. So we're going to dive right in here. And I should note, our theme or our mystery ingredient that we asked the chefs to work with today was apples. So here's some information that I don't know about the first dish.
Dish number one is warm apple crisp with homemade vanilla ice cream and salted caramel.
Okay, so it's this beautiful, we've got some ice cream here. We've got chunks of what appears to be apple, kind of a wonderful cinnamony looking sauce, I guess. I'm grabbing a spoon here. Now, neither of you can say who you are on this, so we are going to have silence for a minute while I take a taste of this. So I'm talking with food in my mouth on Radio Boston right now. It's crunchy. There's a cobblery kind of sugary crustiness to it. The apples are perfectly firm. There's a wonderful cinnamony taste. We're going to try a little bit of ice cream with that, see how it blends. Oh, that's a high-end vanilla ice cream, too. Very, very tasty. Okay, so I absolutely love it, not going to lie, but now it's time to try the second dish.
Dish number two is warm apple cobbler with some cinnamon, nutmeg, and a cake breading topping.
Okay, did I just eat dish number two first, or is this dish number two here? Let me just check. Somebody... We're good. Okay, they're telling me in the control room we're good. So I'm going to pull it a little of this. Now, this is whipped cream. We've got these big apple slices. So it's really, rather than chunks, we've got these big slices of apple with a kind of a darker brown finish. I'm breaking into the cobbler here, grabbing a ridiculously large piece of apple, which is about to go in my mouth all at once. So very different, right? This is kind of a soft, biscuity kind of cobbler. There's a sweet, mellow flavor to it. A little bit of whipped cream on top. I'm kind of a biscuit fan, so I really like the feel of this one. All right, so I'm supposed to pick a winner now. I'm going to go with dish number one. Who was dish number one? This was the warm apple crisp with homemade vanilla ice cream and salted caramel.
That was me.
All right, so Chef Joe Gatto, with dish number one, what inspired you to put together that combination when you were told apples?
Like, honestly, that's my mom. in a dish. That's growing up in the kitchen, just making apple pies, doing things with her all the time. So I wanted it to be as homey as possible. And we make a lot of ice cream at home with the kids because I have three kids, which you know.
Was that homemade ice cream?
Yeah, I made the ice cream and the caramel.
Yep.
And the ice cream is just because my kid. I had to hide all of this. My kids would have destroyed this. They were trying to hunt that caramel all night. So finally I had to squirt a little in their mouth and then had them go on their way. But yeah, that's definitely just growing up and, you know, as being a chef, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like your house always, those smells, they're like culinary poltergeists going through your rooms, you know?
So, Chef Lambeau, I'll turn to you, and it strikes me that Joe talks about his mom with this because, of course, the last time we had you on, it was your grandmother's gumbo that was this winning gumbo on the Food Network. And what I love about your dish, and make no mistake, folks, I would pay serious money to eat either of these, and I would eat way too much, and I would do it all day long. This one has this kind of biscuit base to it. Now, I am a sucker for a biscuit. Like, I would eat a meal of just biscuits. Probably using the wrong word here, but tell me a little bit more about this dish.
So, basically an apple cobbler with a Johnny Cake mix that I kind of, like, added a little twist there.
So,
Johnny Cake mix is a cornmeal, like, based biscuit. Johnny Cakes are just, like, kind of a pancake. They're just cornmeal pancakes.
Yeah, I'm eating more of it right now while you're telling me.
So, It's so delicious. It just kind of, it's gluten-free, and it's just, like, all the, like, good stuff, and just, like, a lighter. I wanted to go with, like, a lighter version, not something that's, it's still early fall, so I just wanted to get something that's just, like, says fall, but still, like, you can have, like, it feels, like, still warm weather.
Okay, so I really like both of you, and I feel almost protective of you having you come in to do this competition, and I was thinking about you, Chef Lambeau. As a former football player, you are a competitive guy.
Oh, for sure, yes.
So I was almost like, what's he going to do? I don't Do you enjoy doing things like this,
putting dishes head to head? Oh, for sure.
So are you ready to try Chef Joe's dish? Now, we're going to have to eat straight out of them because I had to use these.
That's fine.
Okay, so there's spoons here for you guys to use. There's two spoons. And I'm going to have Chef Joe and Chef Lambeau taste each other's dishes and then talk about,
talk about what
you're noticing, what flavors, because you have a discerning palate that is so far beyond anything that I'm capable of. So, Chef Joe, you took the first bite, which means you'll probably swallow sooner. So I'll turn to you first to talk about Chef Lambeau's dish.
The flavor is so homey to me, and that the texture of the Johnny Cake is ridiculous. I love that.
Yeah,
I really do. And the whipped cream just kind of finishes it off really nicely. It's definitely, I love how deep, and I'm going to actually take one more bite because the apples are fantastic.
Okay, so while he takes a bite of the apple, Chef Lambeau, tell me what you think about Chef Joe's creation.
Well, I personally love apple crisp. So it's just like, it's just one of those things that I always like, if I ever see it, like anywhere, if I go to a restaurant, there's like an apple crisp, I'm ordering it. So I love apple crisp. Everything is just like you said, it's like the vanilla ice cream. You can tell it's creamy. It's very rich. Like it's right on point. You can tell it's made from home and made with love. And you can tell this is definitely mom's recipe. This is, you can feel it. So it's just so delicious. Very good.
All right. So I'm going to confess something. In truth, here is what I would really do. I would eat your creation, the warm apple cobbler with the Johnny Cake for dinner. And then Chef Joe, I would eat your apple crisp because of the salted caramel and the ice cream for dessert. And I would eat them both and it would make one apple dinner.
That sounds like my kids' plan for dinner
every night. That's right. So let's talk about apples now a little bit. We've done some features on apples before, but there are choices that you made, not just Chef Lambeau with the corn, the Johnny Cake, and not Joe just with the homemade ice cream, but you made some choices about apples. So I want to know, how did you think about what apples you were going to put into this dish? What apples are best for cooking for you? Joe.
Well, I wanted something tart, so used, you know, the grannies, because I wanted something tart to counterbalance all the sugar that's in there and the sweetness. And, I mean, to tell you the truth, I almost went savory.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about going savory for a little bit, but this, just because it's fall, and you know, Chef, like, it just, it, this was like, oh, make me in the back of my mind. I couldn't get it out of there. So, yeah, I definitely wanted to use the tartar apple just to counterbalance everything.
So that's a Granny Smith.
Yeah.
And are they hard to cook with Granny Smiths? Are they
pretty they're just
easy
like anything else. Super easy.
Okay.
Super easy.
And if somebody couldn't find a Granny Smith in their grocery store, although they're fairly ubiquitous, what's another tart apple you could use instead?
I used Galas for these before, for the last time I made it. And the kids really love that too. It did come out. The apples ended up being a little softer. They're not quite as tart, but it was still caramely goodness.
Yeah. So, okay, Chef Lambeau, how did you think about the apple that you wanted to put in your dish?
I was stuck between a Macintosh and a Granny Smith apple too. But I wanted to hit it with the contrast because I know that Johnny Cakes are kind of savory. So I just kind of with that sweetness. So I doubled down the sweetness with the Macintosh and then I actually reduced some Downy cider to even give like that base of sauce there.
That's good and then
stuff. In my mind, I'm like stealing.
and then like the buttery, the crispiness of the Johnny Cake just kind of completes the whole dish.
Yeah. So when you think about apples that you're going to use in either sweet or savory dishes, what are the kind of the traits that somebody who wants to make a dish at home, I mean, Thanksgiving's coming up soon, Halloween's coming up. What are some of the traits that people who want to think about cooking with apples at home should keep in mind as they're picking what they're going to cook with? Jump on in.
Ooh. I mean, I'm a big believer in cook with what you like. When people ask me, like, even for wines, when they say, you know, what wine should I use here? I'm always like, cook with something that you like to drink. You know, if you're cooking with something that you don't enjoy as a wine, it's not going to get better when you cook with it. And I think it's the same with apples. Just keep in mind the tartness and the sweetness and definitely the texture, because some of the apples can get a little mushy if you overcook them.
So what's the mushy culprit, the worst mushy culprit?
I run into that with Macintosh, personally. I think once you get too long. But these
are not mushy
No, because
at all.
Chef knows what he's doing and he cooked them right.
Yeah, so how did you cook them so they wouldn't get mushy?
So I guess it's part of just like going right into it. You know, just like I didn't boil them or do anything else, like overcook them. It was reduce the sauce. So don't cook them in the sauce. I poured the sauce over them, threw them in the oven for about 15 minutes so they still stay crisp and you can still get that crunch of the bite from the apple. And then after that, it was more of just like putting the dough on top of the cobbler.
So
finishing it off.
And so you bake twice, basically.
Absolutely.
The apples first
yep.
and then the Johnny Cake.
Johnny Cake on top.
Afterward.
Yep.
What do you bake that at, Chef?
375.
Okay.
And is yours baked hot, Chef Joe?
Yeah, everything. It took about 55 minutes at 350.
Yeah. And any other traits that you look for in an apple, Chef Lambeau?
I couldn't agree more with Chef Joe. Honestly, it's just go with what you like. Honestly, it's just like, what's your preference? If you can get to the point of like knowing like which apple that you like cooks better in this. But I mean, if you love a Macintosh, if you love or the Granny Smith or whatever apple that you decide, I think you just kind of go with what you want. And then I think anybody with a sweet tooth will love it.
Right. So listen, the last time I had dishes from the two of you, I would assume. So last time, Chef Joe, it was a Chipotle ice cream.
Oh, that's right. The Chipotle espresso ice cream.
That's right. And with you, Chef Lambeau, it was that incredible gumbo, right? So I don't think that the spices in the two dishes that I just ate were spices that I saw in either of the dishes that I had from either of you before. So what's in here and what are the best fall go-to spices for people who want to try stuff on their own in their kitchens? What's your go-to, Chef Lambeau, in the fall?
So I love brown sugar. So with this one, I'll toss in the recipe here. So I did brown sugar, little apple cider vinegar, just to add a little bit of acid to it, and then reducing the Downy's. I love Downy's cider, so that's like one of my favorite things to do. Mm-hmm. And it's like, obviously, it's apple-based, so that's just like one of the best things that I like to do. So that's my secrets. I like to reducing different flavors of ciders and, you know, kind of making it part of a dessert.
And that acid, is it important with sweet?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it helps the apples, yeah. So, and then also cuts like some of the sugar, so not giving it like too much sugar, but, you know, just not like, so you don't feel like it's over sugaring. You can't taste the apples or everything else that's in the dish.
So listen, I should remind folks, we did an apple sort of taste testing cook-off here between Chef Lambert Givens and Chef Joe Gatto, both of who are friends of Radio Boston and incredible chefs. Joe Gatto, you talk about spices a lot. What are the fall go-tos? What's in here?
I mean, for me, the key to me was cinnamon. And, you know, I ground it myself. So, you know, I obsess over doing stuff like that. Because I really find when you grind it yourself, it just really pops.
How do you do that? How do you grind a cinnamon
stick? So I use my coffee grinder.
Okay, so you can just stick it in there like beans.
Right. I have one that says, you know, no coffee. That's
of
labeled.
Course you do.
And, you know, I grind everything. I use it. We just made chocolate from scratch with my daughter who was here last time.
Yeah.
And we made it from the cacao pods. So we use that to grind some of the nibs. Like, I'm always grinding in that thing. But for me, like, grinding the cinnamon, when you put it into the dish, I just really think it amps it up a lot.
So, Chef Lambeau, last time you were here, we talked about a hypothetical tailgate.
Have you
cooked for any football in the last week or two?
So, actually, not for any football specifically, but we did do some Labor Day weekend caterings and things like that. So we did do a ton of, like, ribs and, you know, wings and mac and cheese, potato salad, coleslaw, all the good stuff, and brisket, pulled pork. Yeah, so we've done a lot of that stuff. And actually, I was just on NBC yesterday, you know, talking about tailgating and how some key secrets just to make your tailgate just a little bit better.
And we will put the link on our website, radioboston.org, to the conversation we had with Chef Lambeau about tailgating, so you can find that again. Joe, have you been cooking for any sports watching or other local events lately? And you
that's
got gonna, something that's on
that's
your
gonna
mind?
That's going to kick up next week.
Yeah.
For sure. I'm going to get some barbacoa tacos going.
What that's is a like, barbacoa taco?
It's just pulled beef and, like, in Mexican spices. It's one of my favorites. The kids love making tortillas at home. Try to get a couple friends over. Hopefully the Patriots will do a little better. But, you know, the food will get us through. And I think my invite must have got lost to that tailgate. But, you know, that's fine. That's fine. I won't hold it against anybody.
Okay, so last question. Are the Patriots going to do better this next time?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. You both feel better about it. Huh?
Yeah.
All right. This was not only fun, but delicious. I actually feel sorry for people listening because they didn't get to taste these dishes. Chef Lambert Givens, executive chef at Hunter's Kitchen and Bar of South Boston, and Chef Joe Gatto, private chef, culinary instructor, host of From Scratch on Pluto TV. Will you both come back again?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thanks to both of you for joining us, and thank you for your delicious apple dishes. There's a horde outside the studio waiting to taste them.
Apple paparazzi.
Yeah. That's right. And that's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks, as always, for listening, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.